Hi, and welcome to Monday. I must say I am impressed, I am pleased, and I congratulate you on actually being here on my way over today, going through that wonderful sunshine and the warm air. I said to myself, anybody who wasn't really totally devoted to the study of human development would be somewhere else this afternoon. So you're all completely devoted. And I really appreciate that. And the sun will still be out, but not as warm when we finish. So I hope you enjoyed a little bit of it today and a lot of it yesterday. A couple of questions for you. We have an exam two weeks from today. I know. And it is traditional to have review sessions. Traditionally, in this course, to have review sessions before each exam. And one of those I will automatically schedule for after class on Wednesday next week. That would be the last lecture before the exam. So after class, I will have a review session. The time will be 5 o'clock and the place will be announced. I would like to offer one over the weekend, Saturday or Sunday. So, this is where I need your response. And Talia, if you could just sort of get a general indication of what the preferences are. So, how many of you would like a review session on the weekend, Saturday or Sunday? How many of you would prefer it on Saturday? And how many of you wish to defile the Sabbath on Sunday? Okay, it's all right. Well, I know some of you don't. The Sabbath isn't on Sunday, but we're not going there. Would you like it in the early afternoon? Raise your hand if yes. Late afternoon on Sunday? Evening on Sunday. Looks like we need a compromise between late afternoon and evening. Like 5 o'clock? 6 o'clock? 7 o'clock? Looks like 5 o'clock? Okay. Yes. No, the day before the exam, which will be 2 weeks from yesterday, the review session will be 2 weeks from yesterday. I'm sorry? First? I don't know. I have a friend who keeps her calendar in her head for months and months and months and all of her appointments. I can't do that. So yes, that would be October 1st. The exam is on the 2nd. We will have a review session on Sunday about 5-ish. I will find a room and let you know where. It will be on campus. It'll be bringing your own dinner. How many of you would like a review session on Thursday or Friday? Okay. Do you prefer Thursday or Friday? Do you prefer late after? What's your schedule? Okay. Thursday, late afternoon or evening? Friday, morning. Afternoon. Thursday at 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, okay. Friday afternoon, okay. I'm not going to suggest Friday evening. Is Thursday at 5 seem best? That's the 28th. And that will depend on finding a room. Okay. Okay. We will announce those. We'll post them on the website. We'll post them here. I will probably send you an email about them, along with other nagging reminders about the exam. Question? I'm sorry. The last class before the exam, a week from Wednesday, I will have a review session. That's traditional. You can count on that. Always the last lecture of each unit, there will be a review session immediately after. While it's fresh in my mind. Okay? Did you have other questions?
If anyone's interested in having another study group or being part of the study group listserv thing that I started, I'll leave a piece of paper down, and after class you can add your name to it. I've been hearing that there's one going from 8 to 9 on Wednesday at the library. I'm assuming that's PM.
Oh.
I know. And I also have my office hours, and some people were talking about coming by during office hours as a group. Other than that, I haven't heard very much discussion about it, so you might want to get talking. I'm not going to be at everybody's study group, but if you have questions and have four or five people that want to come to me, that's fine.
Okay. Good. How many of you are actively involved in a study group now? Okay. Those are the A's. Hoping to be within the next week. Okay. So, get them set up. Talia is very helpful. Other questions? Housekeeping stuff? You're easy. Okay. I'm sorry, was that a question? No. Okay. I thought it was. Just, okay. I'm down here. All right. Questions about content? Did we get this kid born? Yes. Whoop! Out it came. We didn't have to spank it because it was all set to go, right? Because of the contractions, squeezing the brain, it secreted corticosteroids, stress hormones, and so its heart rate was up, its blood pressure was up, it was ready to clear its lungs, and it started to breathe and perhaps cry because of that. And rarely do we have to spank a newborn to get it to breathe. They just usually do that all on their own. So, we'll talk about adaptations that have to be made at birth. And we've mentioned your umbilical cord regularly. We didn't do this, did we? We didn't do the umbilical cord. Okay, we talked about where it was. And why it came through the abdomen. It was actually formed before the abdominal wall was formed. So it is out. This is handmade. It's crude. There's the placenta, the umbilical cord, the abdominal wall, and the vein comes up through the umbilical cord, through the abdominal wall, up through the liver and toward the heart. And what that vein is doing, unlike the other veins after birth, what it's doing is bringing the oxygenated air blood from the placenta and the nutrients and bringing them up through the liver and then into the heart so that they can be distributed through the rest of the body. From the heart, you have two arteries, which are taking the waste product-filled blood down through the umbilical cord so that they can be disposed of through the placenta. The umbilical cord also has a connection to the bladder, and that connection allows more of the concentrated waste products from the kidney to be disposed of. Now you get born. Your placenta is detached from the uterus, and there you are outside. What have you got left? Well, the umbilical cord and placenta are gone, disposed of, however. And you don't need any of those connections, those tubes that went through it. So the arteries atrophy, they wither. The vein coming up through the liver atrophies, and they become essentially little withered up cords, which are called ligamenta. They are in infants still attached to the umbilicus, to the scar. They come up, the ligamentum teres is connected to the liver. Eventually you outgrow them, but for some of us they remain connected, but they're just unused leftover tubes that have no function anymore, and they are typically removed whenever you do abdominal surgery. They will still be there, connected someplace, maybe. Okay. So that's one of the things that you have to do. Now, what that means is that a whole bunch of things that used to happen because you were connected to your mother's uterus through the placenta, a whole bunch of those things aren't happening anymore. So circulation has to change. Where are you going to get your oxygen? You're going to get your oxygen through the lungs. The umbilical cord is useless, so the blood is now flowing, but its direction is changing so that the blood is going up through the lungs, and that means that your heart has to function differently. So one of the major changes that happens is that instead of passing blood through the heart from one upper chamber to the other and back down through the body, bypassing for the most part the lungs because it didn't need to go to the lungs, you need now to increase the pressure in that upper chamber, and you need to move that blood, and this is the kind of bottom line story, you have to move that blood from the upper chamber into the lungs and then back down through the other upper chamber rather than have the blood pass between them. Prenatally, you have an opening between the two upper chambers called the foramen ovale. And that has to close in order to force the blood to go up into the lungs, where it will be oxygenated and get rid of the carbon dioxide and other waste gases. So that opening between the two chambers of the heart has to close off. That happens for several reasons, but partly because of change in pressure and partly because of the beginning filling of the lungs with air. And that opening closes off. There's a ready-made valve ready to go in between, and that closes off over the first 2 or 3 days. It doesn't always close off all the way. So some people have what we call a hole in the heart left over from prenatal life. So that adaptation doesn't happen. And then we need to consider surgery to close that off, because if you don't close it off, you're not going to get enough blood up into the lungs, so you're going to be oxygen deprived, and that is going to keep you from exerting yourself, growing normally, and make you susceptible to fatigue if you get enough up there to keep you alive, enough blood through the lungs to get enough oxygen to keep you alive in the first place. So when we say you're born with a hole in your heart, Actually, everybody is born with a hole in the heart. What you have that is a problem is a hole that doesn't close. For most of us, the hole closes, and then you can send the blood up to the lungs. And the reason it's doing that is because you need the lungs, because you don't have a placenta anymore. So the lungs are all ready to fill up with air. You have to get the fluid out of them first. So at birth, you need to expand the lungs. They've been expanding. You've been engaging in breathing action, taking amniotic fluid in and expelling it. So the muscles are all ready to go. You've done that for a couple of months before delivery. But at delivery, you need to get the fluid out of your lungs and expand the lungs further and get air into them and start breathing in and out. And that typically happens fairly normally. If it doesn't, then you have a big problem. If the lungs are filled with other stuff, as occasionally but rarely happens, then trying to get that stuff out may damage the air sacs in the lung and you have problems. So you need to breathe because, again, you don't have a placenta taking in oxygen from mother. This, we talked about jaundice early on, so I'm not going to go over this one in detail, but the liver has to start functioning at a much greater rate than it did before. The liver has to create the enzymes that break down the metabolic byproducts and help to detoxify your blood. If they don't, then you build up byproducts from metabolism, what you've eaten, getting broken down, and you can't break it down sufficiently, particularly the bilirubin, and that, as we said early on, is a yellow fatty substance that builds up in the skin where the body stores it so that it can be broken down by light if you're exposed to light, or phototherapy if you're in the newborn nursery. We need to put you under grow lights to break it down. You have to keep ahead of it until the liver starts to function adequately. If the bilirubin builds up to high levels, it damages the nervous system and can cause retardation. It can damage brain and eventually cause death if you have too much of it. And I think I said at the time we talked about that, that the phototherapy was begun here by Jerry Lucy, who was studying what to do with newborns. You also have to get your kidney functioning at a higher level. And the kidney is extremely important as an internal organ because it keeps the acid and base concentrations in balance. And that's important for cell function and particularly for nerve conduction. You have to have the right amount of electrolytes, so you're taking out of your food whatever you need, potassium, calcium, and keeping those in balance. And you're also maintaining the blood volume through the action of the kidney. So without the placenta and mom's kidneys, you have to do all of this. Okay, all of those are because the placenta has detached, and all of them are an adaptation to birth that are necessary. They are all adaptations that are necessary because you're out of the uterus and you don't have a placenta connected. So you're on your own, and those internal organs and those changes are necessary to maintain life as an eating, breathing, taking care of yourself, little organism. It's incredible. All these wonderful things happen. And we don't do anything. They just happen. And they're just built in. The other thing I want to talk about newborns is the sensory system and what they are likely to do. Newborns are amazing little creatures because they come prepared at birth to engage the caretakers around them in the activities that are going to help them survive. And we don't just put them on the table and walk away. They do things that elicit caretaking behavior in adults. Adults and children, teenagers, male and female, we all have essentially the same physiological responses to a crying baby. We all do the same things when we meet a baby for the first time. So those seem to be built into the species, and in part, they're dependent on the baby playing its part. So it's a transaction between people who have reactions to newborns, and not just newborn humans, but newborns of other species as well. And a baby, a transaction between that older human being and a baby who comes prepared to do things that will meet the expectations of the adult. So what are those? Well, the first thing that got studied a lot is vision. And babies come with very well-developed eyes and visual systems. I have a little complaint with the text. The text says that the visual system is the least developed of the sensory system, but they don't tell you what they mean by that. And I'm not sure what they mean by that, because in fact the eye is fairly mature. It is prepared to see, it does see. And the text also says that it cites some older research, 10 or 15 years old, and I think they misinterpret it. I have to go back and look at the original research. But what they suggest is that acuity is really bad, like 2400, which means that the newborn would be able to see something 20 feet away that you, as an adult, could see at 400 feet away. Well, that's misleading. It's misleading because you have to distinguish two aspects of perception. One is acuity, which is the ability to discriminate details, and the newborn's eye can do that almost as well as the adult. The lens and the retina, assuming the eye is normal shape, and most babies' eyes are, the individual eye will be able to distinguish lines that are quite close together. And we measure acuity by seeing how close together you can get those lines and still see them as two lines. And the eye of the newborn is almost as acute or able to distinguish those two lines as an adult. But you have to distinguish that from accommodation, which has actually nothing to do with the shape of the eye or the maturity of the eye. Accommodation is a motor skill. And the newborn has not exercised the muscles that control the focal point of the eye. Accommodation is what the infant doesn't have because it hasn't had anything to look at. You know, most of us don't experience photographers sticking fiber optics into the uterus and turning on bright lights. If you do that, babies will turn away from them and blink, but or move their eyes. After certain months, the eyes are closed and won't open again until about birth. But accommodation is the problem for newborns. And the fascinating thing, now this is accommodation. How many of you know what accommodation is? Right, that's what I figured. Okay, put your finger up in front of your face. Okay, look at it. And while you're looking at your finger, think about everything else that is in your field of vision. Kind of blurry, huh? If you're looking at me, there may be an orange blob down here in front of the board somewhere. Right? Now, look at me. Look at me. Okay? Now go back to your finger. Then look at me. Then look at your finger. You feel what your eyes are doing? Look at me, look at your finger, look at me, look at your finger. You are moving your eyeballs. You're using muscles. And you are able to do that because you have practiced moving your eyeballs to make the focal point at the point where you can see most clearly. So acuity is the ability to distinguish the lines and the objects and me. Accommodation is the ability to change the focal length so that you can look at something that is close up and something far away and move your eyes back and forth, and infants can't do that. The text correctly says that the focal length of the average infant, most infants, is about a foot away from the face. So if you want to know what a newborn sees, put your finger up about a foot from your nose. Don't look at your nose. That'll cause your eyes to cross, and your grandmother said they'll get stuck there someday, right? You practice that. Okay, now you're looking at your finger about a foot away from your nose. You can see your finger quite clearly. Well, I can if I use my bifocals. There. Finger's in focus, hand is in focus. You are a big mass of blurry color. I know there are people there, but I can't discriminate any of you. That's what a newborn sees, because its focal length is fixed at birth at about 10 to 12 inches out. Now, this is one of those things that absolutely blows my mind, because there is absolutely no reason for every human newborn to come with its focal length fixed at about 10 inches out there. Theoretically, with muscles that have not been exercised for anything, focal length could be random from the end of your nose to infinity. But it's not random. It's fixed there. It's fixed there. And because the muscles have not been exercised, you can't really change it. When you try to change it, then you get random. And if you watch newborns, they look at whatever's 10 to 12 inches away, and then when something catches their attention by moving in that field out there, they try to focus on it. But they can't. So what you get is these random movements of the eyes, and they one focus, they don't come together, and it's really bizarre. Next time you get a newborn in your arms, just watch the eyes, because you can tell where somebody's looking, and you try to figure out where the newborn is trying to look, and it just can't control the eyes, so the eyes wander, but it's trying. And in that wandering, in the practice, in the attempts, the newborn will exercise those muscles, and over the course of 5 or 6 months will reach the point where it can accommodate, follow anything, change its focal length, focus on whatever's in the visual field between its nose and infinity just about as well as you can. Okay, but that's a motor skill that has to be exercised. If the muscles are there, they will get exercised. So what the infant does is come at us this way, and the text correctly suggests that maybe that's an evolutionary advantage, because if you hold a baby to nurse it and look at it, your face is going to be 10 to 12 inches away from its eyes. And if you're nursing it in the standard human position, the way all humans, females, and males holding bottles, we do it the same way. We don't put the kid out there and shove a bottle in its mouth. If you're going to put it at the breast, you can, with skill, tuck it under your arm and have it looking out that way. But people don't do that. People pick up an infant and they put it here And they look at it, and their eyes and the infant's eyes are locked on each other, and there it is, and the infant is quite happily looking at whoever's breastfeeding it. And that's an advantage. What the text doesn't say is that there may be another advantage. There may be another advantage. And that advantage is that if you're not nursing and just hanging out all by yourself, there's another really, 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 really important thing in the world to look at. Any ideas? Yeah, except you can't see yourself. Well, what can you see about yourself? Yeah, and your hands. And if you measure the distance that the newborn's hands are away from its eyes when it is unswaddled and has freedom to move, is moving its arms randomly, the average distance is the same. So the newborn comes at life prepared to look at that point, the two most important things in the world. Its hands and whoever's feeding it. And the eyes come pre-focused at that distance. That blows my mind. Infants also, it says there, have a preference for edges and contrast and moderate complexity and for anything that looks like a face. And if you give them comparison tests and see what they like to look at most by comparing things, they like anything that has about the same complexity as a face. Then they like something that's organized like a face. Even more, they like something that's organized like a face and the same color as a face. And then they like schematics of real faces that look really like faces. And then they like photographs of faces. And then after about 3 days, they prefer the photograph of the person who is actually feeding them. And if you give them a choice between the real face of that person and the photograph, they prefer the real face. What that means is that within a few days, if you're the person who's feeding the infant and you've been doing that regularly, the infant prefers to look at you compared to anybody else. And it's that looking at the person who is feeding it consistently that provides one of the foundation blocks for becoming attached. So within a few days, you're showing a preference for somebody that you will become attached to. You'll become bonded with. You'll become really emotionally important to you. Question? Yes, babies are not very discriminating in their social relationships as long as you're providing something in its mouth that it likes. And are doing that regularly and not scaring it while you hold it, you're becoming familiar, it will begin to be attached with you, and babies do normally develop attachments for anybody who feeds them and takes care of them in a consistent, reasonable way. Some infants are born with visual impairments, either because the eye is misshapen. Typically, that's the shape of the eyeball has to be just right to get the lens to focus the incoming light directly on the retina. So some infants don't. Their eyes are misshapen. Sometimes there are malformations of other sorts in the eye. Some of you probably did start wearing glasses very, very early. Many of us wait till puberty when, during the process of puberty, our eyes develop astigmatisms because they don't grow the same or they sort of focus the image behind or in front of. So I put these glasses on when I was 14 and haven't taken them off yet, except to switch them to bifocals because puberty did that to me. And I discovered that as I set the strikeout record in Little League that year. I couldn't see the ball. Yeah. Five times in one game. And nobody worried about that. They just figured I was a lousy baseball player. Okay. So they were happy, you know, when the season was over and Larry wouldn't go up to bat anymore. But when I got into the classroom freshman year of high school and couldn't see the board from the front row, you know, then, oh, wait a minute, maybe it's not just he's a lousy athlete, maybe his eyes don't work well.
You know if the infant would prefer a photo of the person who sees it?
Yes.
Or the face of an actual person?
The question is, would the infant prefer a photo of a person who's feeding it or the actual person who is feeding it?
No, the actual face of someone who doesn't
feed it. Because the photo of the person who is feeding it will be of more interest than the actual stranger. It depends partly on the degree of familiarity and also the degree of similarity between the two faces. Sometimes babies will study the face of somebody who looks like the familiar person. They'll study that face for a long time, but they'll move back and forth between them trying to figure out which one is really the milk giver. Okay, let me move beyond vision to hearing. Babies can hear. Babies hear in utero. If we could study them more easily, we would probably discover that they can discriminate all kinds of sounds in utero. And what's fun about babies hearing is that they have greatest responsiveness in a narrow range. And that narrow range is the range of the human voice. And not only that, they actually are more responsive to the female human voice, the high end of the human range. That, like vision, is predisposing the newborn to respond to female caregivers. And some people have argued that this is learned because they've been in utero, but actually if you listen to the recordings in utero, it's a little hard to pick out the specifics of voices in utero. But remember, they're in amniotic fluid and water is a fairly good conductor. What they're more likely to pick up in utero is the rhythm of voice. And babies do prefer their mother's voices shortly after birth. But that's the one they've been hearing most. Been hearing it in a strange way. Do you want to know how a baby hears its mother's voice? The best approximation you can make is to stick your fingers in your ears and talk. Go ahead and do that. Just put your fingers in your ears and start talking to yourself out loud. Go ahead. It's okay. Talk. That's weird, isn't it? That's weird. But what you're getting is the sound through bone conduction and the sound through your head from your larynx through the soft tissue and bone conduction into your ears. But it's coming in a different path rather than going through the tympanum directly. And that's what babies hear, because they're getting the mother's voice through the liquid medium and through her body tissues. So it's muffled, it's garbled. It doesn't sound like mother's voice really. So when you actually play mother's voice, it's most, and compare it to other voices, because these are discrimination tests, what's likely to happen, I think, is that you're getting the mother's voice pattern and tone rather than the specific voice qualities, other pitch qualities.
Do you think that's one of the reasons why,
absolutely. Everybody raises their voice to infants. Everybody. And we do that because babies are most responsive. So we go, goochie, 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 goochie. We go way up in our heads and we do the falsetto crap. But it's stuck. And we do that because it works. When I say babies are responsive, what that means is there are two ways babies can respond to sound. If they're being relatively active, not focusing on anything, they can alert. So they get still and they listen. And you can tell when a baby's doing that. Or if they're still, what did I just say? They alert. They activate if they're being still. They activate. They start to move. So you can see both of those responses. And babies can hear very, very well across the whole range of human auditory capacity, which is about 20 hertz cycles per second, way down there. The bottom note on your piano, the lowest note, is 28 cycles per second. So humans can hear below the piano. And we hear up to about 20,000, maybe 21,000. Except that as you get older, you lose the top. So in one of my ears, I'm down to about 16.5. And the other ear, I'm down to about 18. Which means I can't hear that high-pitched, annoying sound that used to drive me nuts emanating from the television. There was an electronic hum up there in the 19,000, 20,000. Just drove me nuts. I don't hear it anymore. And what's happened is that I've lost some of the cells. They've died in the inner ear. They are destroyed by turning your iPod up too high, going to rages, standing in front of the speakers at the concert. You are blowing away your hearing. And you can lose it at the top, and it's irreplaceable. Chainsaws. I didn't go to raves or rages. We didn't have big speakers when I was young enough. Chainsaws, floor sanders, things like that, fireworks. Shotgun once. That's the bad ear. I almost got my head blown off. Rabbit hunting, the last day I went rabbit hunting. Friend, right past, broke my eardrum. Bad stuff. The infant responds across that whole range. The human voice produces, if you're male and you're saying the sustained vowels tend to be around 125, and then the male voice goes up to about 950. Yeah, so that's the range for the guys. And for females, it's up there to about 1200. The top note on your piano is 4214. Up there. Babies respond selectively to sounds that are within that 200 to 1200 range compared to anything higher or lower. Within that range, they prefer the higher end to alert them. To alert them. If you're trying to make a baby respond and get it to respond to you and pay attention and wake up, you go up to that high end and you talk real high, or you are a female. I mean, you don't have to do it because I have to work at it, and it hurts my voice to talk to newborns, which is why I don't like babies. that just slipped out. But this is something the text doesn't tell you. If you're trying to calm a baby, if you want to get it to relax, you go down. You go down and you slow. Which is why lullabies sung at the top of the soprano range don't work. they don't work. Lullabies are sung by contraltos or baritones or basses, and they're sung softly because that calms a baby. So if you want to alert it and arouse it, you give it to mom, or you have dad fake being mom by raising his voice way up there, and then the kid gets all excited. But if the baby is already excited and crying, guys, I'm about to spoil it for you, I'm sorry. Hand a crying baby to its father. This drives mothers nuts, that fathers typically can calm a crying baby more easily than mothers can, because their voices are lower and they tend to speak more slowly, and they know how to do this. Smart mothers learn this quickly. So the high end of the human voice is arousing, the low end of the human voice is calming, which is why whenever you're dealing with anybody who's upset, anybody, you'll learn this when you work with disturbed kids, you'll learn this when you work in the emergency room, whenever somebody is really upset, the best thing you can do is to lower your voice. Lower it, make it softer, put it down in the lower range, and speak slowly. Going the other way arouses people, and you don't want them to be upset when they're already upset. So you drop your voice. You learn that in conflict management training.
What's really happening when your ears ring?
When your ears ring?
Yeah. Someone
Well, many things can lead to a feeling or a hearing, a perception of ringing. I'm not going to touch that one. The question is it possible that men are more effective in calming crying babies because women tend to speak more and they're likely to get anxious about the fact that the baby is crying?
When you're anxious, your voice goes.
Yeah. Men also get anxious in the presence of crying babies, and the physiological response is the same. And I don't know why men are more likely to lower their voices. When in fact stress typically will cause you to constrict your vocal cords. Back to the question about, what was it?
Why
do your ears ring? Tinnitus, sometimes because you've overstimulated your ears, sometimes because you have chemicals happening in your body that are stimulating your auditory nerve. Sometimes because something bad is going on in your brain. I can make up probably more, but we don't need to. Okay. So, I don't know why. I don't know why your ears ring. Mine only ring when people are talking about me. Okay, importantly... Migrating birds probably are listening to waves. Some of them are listening to waves. One cycle per second, two cycles per second, or less. They're actually hearing. You can see it, but they're hearing it. Below 20, you can feel a vibration, but your ears don't respond. Dogs, through the whole human range plus, I don't know how high, anybody know? 25,000? That's why your dog whistle, the silent dog whistle, is actually creating a sound, but you can't hear it. It's just above your range. Dolphins, up to 100,000 cycles per second. Incredible. Things that we can't hear, we can't even feel at 100,000 cycles per second. They use... and they produce. Okay. Other things about newborns. They prefer speech to other sounds. And they have the ability to discriminate every sound that's used in any human language. That is really cool. The brain is prepared to discriminate all of the sounds that you can make. Many human languages use sounds that we don't make. Any of you grew up in a language that uses tongue clicks or sounds that aren't made in English? Most of us have trouble enough with French R's. But there are many languages that use sounds that we just don't produce. We can when we're babies, but after we start imitating speech, trying to produce the sounds that we're hearing and start to babble, then we lose that ability. Our brain loses the flexibility. So that if you try to learn a language after, particularly after puberty, when it really goes away, most of us have a great deal of difficulty learning to pronounce and to hear distinctions in sounds in languages other than our own. Newborns also come responsive to stroking, to holding, to massaging. The skin surface and musculature are responding, and babies like to be held in ways that support them fully. And they like to be moved at their own pace. They don't like to be jostled, jiggled, thrown, until a little bit later when the boys do. They like to throw them around. They like the displacements that are a little larger. But babies come prepared to be held, and particularly to be held with two hands, and to have their heads stabilized and their backs supported. Whether you do it with their head up like this or down, as long as they're fully supported and nothing is dangling, they'll be happy. And if you're warm, they will also then snuggle into you. They will find a way to mold their body to your body. And we expect that. They expect it. So what's happening in the newborn days is that you're creating a transaction between the caregiver and the infant that is as smooth as possible. So the caregiver is adjusting voice and motion to soothe the baby most effectively. The baby is figuring out how loud it has to cry, how to move, how to suck, how to look, how to respond to the voice, so that it's developing familiarity with whoever's taking care of it. And the baby will begin to push back. If its reflexes are such that when you push it, it will push back. We expect that. We expect a response. And that's setting up a reciprocal game between caregivers and mothers, caregivers and infants, caregivers and other humans. Infants. Okay? Now, at that point, the baby has all of these wonderful reflexes, which I just mentioned, and the part you want to look at really closely in the text, I think starts on page 143. My overhead says 141, but that's the old text. And I want to point out two particular quotes from Esther. One is from Esther Talon and the other is from Papalia. Infant and environment form an interconnected system. And from Talon, motor development is a continuous process of interaction between the baby and the environment. Development of motor skills happens because the body and the brain are both developing, they're maturing. The baby is motivated to make something happen. It likes to have an effect on the world. Its physical characteristics, its sensory system and its motor skeletal musculature system are set up to act, to move, to respond, and eventually to become integrated. Those are the physical characteristics. It can kick its legs, therefore it will kick its legs. The legs are made to be kicked. It's a kick whip, that's why you have them. The hand is made to grasp. That's what it does best. So the baby will grasp with it. But it's going to have to learn to coordinate all of the different parts of its body. And it does that because it's motivated to make things happen. In a particular setting, the infant will have particular opportunities and particular things that it can't do, particular constraints. So what you have in looking at physical development, particularly motor development, is a motivated baby trying to use its body, a body that is going to do particular things because that's the way it's built. You will not bend your arm the wrong way. It doesn't work. The body is made to hug this way. Right? You ever tried to hug somebody behind you like that? You can't do it. The body won't do it. It's not built that way. The body has potentials. And it has the potentials of its structures and the reflexes that are built into it. And the baby will start with those and it will exercise them. It will exercise them in an environment that has particular characteristics. So if its environment has stairs, it will figure out as it starts to raise its head that it can put its chin on the stair. It'll figure out that it can put its hand on the stair, and it'll figure out that it can push against the stair. Stairs are really interesting to push against because it helps you roll over away from the stair. And then eventually, because you have a stair, you're going to learn to crawl up the stair. And you're going to do that because it's there. If it's there. If it's not there, you won't learn. So what you have is every particular baby in a particular environment that is encouraging it and allowing it to do particular things. So if its environment puts a soccer ball, a little one, on the floor as the kid is learning to walk, it's going to push that soccer ball along with its feet. If you never have a soccer ball, you're not going to learn to dribble. If you never have stairs, you're not going to learn to climb stairs. If you never have roller skates, you're never going to learn to roller skate. What the baby is doing is adapting itself to the particular environment that it has. And environments will encourage some kinds of skills and not encourage other kinds of skills. So one of the things that we don't do very well in our culture is encourage kids to walk early. If you want your kids to learn to walk early, then you make sure, and to be comfortable with that, you make sure that they grow up with something to stand up against every place they are. And you create a path for them. So a kid can go all the way around the living room, moving from thing to thing before it can balance on its own. And if you have those things for the kid to pull up against and to hang on to and to practice holding on to, it will learn to cruise. And it'll go wherever it can cruise. And then when it can't cruise, it runs out of cruising room, it'll go back to crawling. In some cultures, they provide cruising rails from house to house in the village to make sure that a kid can get there and can walk, doesn't have to crawl. That promotes mobility. It promotes socialization because you have the opportunity to go as soon as you can stand up. Very quickly learn to put one foot in front of the other before you've learned to balance. A quick summary of physical development. This is what the baby is doing. It's actually starting this before it's born. But once it's born, It continues to exercise all the parts of the body. And that activity strengthens muscles and ligaments. If you don't exercise, you don't develop strength.
Duh. Okay.
More importantly is that exercise is necessary for bone growth. If you are born, when you are born, I'm sorry, not if, when you are born, you have these funny shaped hips. You've been folded up in utero, and the bottom of your hip, where the head of your femur goes, is relatively flat. So then you've got this bone up there, and the ball and socket joint is incomplete. And if you don't stand up and bear weight on that, so the femur is pushing up against the bone, you exercise that. If you don't exercise it, the head of the femur and the hip will not form a socket. What you want in order to be able to run and to walk without knocking your hip out of place, your leg out of place, is a round socket that you can fit the head of the femur into. That femur, that head will only, I'm sorry, the socket will only grow if you're putting pressure on the hip. So for kids who don't stand up for a long time, kids who have motor problems, one of the long-term difficulties is that they're not going to create a fully formed socket. Down syndrome adults are notorious for suffering in adulthood an inability to run. And they have that inability to run because they're what we call hypotonic. In infancy, they don't have strength. Hypo, not enough. Tone, not enough firmness, not enough strength in their legs, so they don't exercise as much as other kids do, and they walk very late. And one of the things that we've learned to do with kids who are hypotonic is to stand them up, put them on our laps, put them in seats that will hold them, suspend them, so that they can bounce against the floor without having to hold their whole weight themselves, because their musculature isn't adequate for them to hold their whole weight. So we hold them, we bounce them. And that bouncing and the opportunity to stand up and bounce is creating the hip joint. And if you don't do that, for whatever reason, then you end up with a hip that is easily displaced. So one of the things that we do with people who are not getting enough exercise, who don't have enough tone, particularly in infancy and toddlerhood, is to make them bounce. Put weight. Bicycle them. Put them on their backs and move their legs back and forth. What we're doing is stimulating the growth of the bone to create the hip socket. Exercise is necessary for creating bone density. All of the bone density that you create up through adolescence through exercise is more important over the rest of your life than all the calcium supplements you will be trying to get down your gullet in adulthood because you didn't drink enough milk and didn't exercise enough when you were a child. You'll be playing catch-up, and you'll never catch up. So creating bone growth and bone density is a result of exercise. It starts in utero and continues and lasts the rest of your life. That exercise is also creating connections in your brain and consolidating the pathways. Your brain is maturing in part because of the exercise that you're getting. That combination leads to voluntary control. If you practice something, if you exercise it, you will gradually get control over that motion and be able to separate specific movements or differentiate them and when you exercise or practice, you encourage coordination and integration of those separate movements into more complex systems. That combination is differentiation of the parts of your body and gaining control over the individual movements that you can make. That is a very significant part of development in motor skills and in everything else. The text has this problem. It defines differentiation and integration only in terms of nerve cells. But differentiation and integration apply to all kinds of development: social relationships, motor skills, cognitive understanding, everything. So keep that in mind. When you exercise, you are practicing separating specific movements. Okay? So one finger at a time. Right? One part of the body. You have to differentiate the left from the right so you can alternate. What babies do is move globally, undifferentiated, both legs at the same time, back and forth, and eventually they have to figure out how to move one leg at a time. You can't walk unless you can move one leg at a time. You can't crawl unless you can move one hand at a time and one knee at a time. So you have to differentiate the left side from the right side. It also helps if you're crawling that you not extend all four limbs at the same time. What happens if you extend all four limbs at the same time? Here I am. I've differentiated top and bottom, but I have to differentiate left and right. And I have to figure out how not to. I'm not going to do it, but you can imagine what will happen if I try to pick up my left knee and my left hand at the same time. Right? Where am I going? On the floor. This will not be a good demonstration, except for the EMTs in the group. But if I try to extend all of them, I end up back on my tummy, which is not where I want it to be. I have to figure out if I'm going to roll over. Here's an exercise for you. How did you learn to roll over? I have to figure out how to pull one side in and extend the other side. So I've got to, okay, let's see. I'm going to pull this end in and I'm going to raise this knee. I'm going to, you can't see me because I'm too far, too close. Okay. Okay, how am I going to turn over? Well, that doesn't work. Figure that out. What I need to do is get my arm under me and a leg out and a hand out and then push, but only with one side. Then I can go over, bang my head on the floor and start to cry, and Mom comes in and says, oh, baby turned over spontaneously. It's hard work. It's exercise. And that's the important thing about motor skills is that we expect kids to do these things. They all take great effort. Learning to control... I've got five more minutes. I'm going to use them. If you are trying to hold your head steady, you have to develop the motor control and the strength in the muscles to be able to hold it steady. That takes work. If you're learning to get up on your hands and knees, if you're learning to sit up, if you're learning to get down, if you're learning to stand up and get down, all of those require practice over and over and over again, and kids burn a huge number of calories just learning to be mobile. They will work on something that they are trying to accomplish until they are exhausted, and they will get to the point where they will cry. They'll work up a sweat, they'll get hungry faster, they will start to cry, and then at some point they will just fall asleep because they're totally exhausted. Question?
Do you think it's like really bad for a baby?
The text, and Thalen particularly, makes the point that when you put together the kid's motivation and the environment that it's in, you're going to learn to do something that works. And as you mature, you'll figure out something else that works. You'll do it more efficiently. But there's no evidence that we have to learn to crawl. What you do have to learn to do is differentiate left and right and develop an alternating gait, but you can do that walking. What we do have to do is strengthen our back so we can hold our head up. You have to do that when you walk as well. So while there have been claims that you have to go through each of the stages, none of those claims are supported by research. The research says kids will learn what works in their environment. Example, I have to take the iPod out because I dropped it on its nose last time I did this. My daughter was learning to crawl in Pittsburgh in the spring, and it was nice weather, so we had her outside. She hated the grass. She also hated the grit in the lawn. And she particularly hated it on her knees. So crawling for her outside was crazy. And she could cover space very quickly. And people would see her do that and think, what is she doing? She's moving in a way that works, and she's protecting her knees from the tickling grass and the sandpaper grit that Pittsburgh lawns all have. So that the point, again, is that kids will do what their bodies will permit them to do, so that limits. They will use the possibilities, and they will do what they want to do, and what they want will depend on what's available in the environment. And what the environment discourages, they're less likely to do. What the environment encourages, whether it's playing soccer or yo-yoing or riding a bicycle or climbing palm trees to get coconuts, what the environment encourages them to do, they will learn to do. There will be variations in how they'll do it because it's an individual process. It's not built in its details. Every child constructs his or her motor skills on his own. There will be variation in how skilled we are, and that will depend on the potentials within our body, which are genetic, and the motivation that we develop, and how much is encouraged or not in a particular environment. And we'll go on from there on Wednesday.